The world's becoming a little bit better of absorbing some of the geopolitical risk, but still, where geopolitical risk impacts supply chains or rerouting of supply chains is an area where we as commodity traders, if we're best informed in the marketplace, can identify those risks and or opportunities and then exploit those through our trading strategy.
Hi everyone, welcome to the NZX podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and in today's episode I'm joined by Adam Davis, Faro Capital Management, for an insightful discussion on how to navigate global commodity trends. But first, I'm joined by NZX Dairy Analyst Lewis Hoggard for an insightful update on global dairy markets. Lewis, what's going on in the world of dairy?
Yeah, g'day, James. In the world of dairy, there's been a bit of milk production data in the past wee while. The US has released milk production data for March, which was down 1% year on year. That's roughly in line with the sort of market expectations. We also had NZ milk production for March down 1.2%, which was a little bit above what we expected, but still there or thereabouts. We expected negative 1.6. There's been quite a lot of regional variation. There's some green droughts happening around the place, especially lower North Island, Marlborough as well. Waikato and Southland still very strong. They've kind of been carrying through pretty well with this El Nino, which is now officially finished. For April, we're forecasting NZ production to be down 1.1% year on year. For prices, the last GDT event, second event in April, was very flat. Not a lot of movement for milk powders. Skim milk powder was completely flat. Cheese, however, was down 8.5%, which was a pretty huge drop, but cheese has just been all over the place recently, lots of volatility. For whole milk powder, it was interesting to see Fonterra's announcement prior to the event where they changed their sales profile over through the end of this season and next season a little bit, which kind of pointed towards a little bit less product going through the end of this season and a lot more coming on in the peak next season. But these changes come into effect from May onwards, so we didn't see any price movement responding to that in April. We've also, like, on the back of that, we've also done a bit of analysis recently on stream returns for the whole milk powder versus skim milk powder and fat streams. At the moment, it's very clear that whole milk powder has the weakest returns at the moment, just not enough demand from China. Butter and AMF, very strong at the moment. Butter's about as high as it's been in a while. The skim butter stream is quite a bit more lucrative than the whole milk powder stream. We're expecting processors to ramp up butter production as much as they can. And until there's a meaningful increase in demand from China for whole milk powder, I just don't think we're going to see those streams converge for a while. But yeah, that's about it.
Thanks, Lewis. Plenty to keep an eye on over the coming months. Definitely Middle East conflict, as well as China demand and milk production globally, all things creating a bit of volatility. So with that, thanks, Lewis. Great insight. And up next, Adam Davis. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm now joined by Adam Davis, Faro Capital Management. Adam is co-founder and chief investment officer at Faro Capital. He has more than 20 years' experience in global commodity investment and an extensive track record in building and executing profitable trading strategies. Faro Capital is an Australian headquartered hedge fund specializing in trading of global agricultural commodity markets. Adam, thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
Yeah, great, James. Thanks very much for having me.
No worries. As I was discussing, you've recently launched Faro Capital Management. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, look, Faro Capital is, as you mentioned, an Australian-based hedge fund. So the business is very much a spin out of my previous role and previous firm, Merricks Capital, which where I ran commodities for 15 years as an Australian-based hedge fund, trading across grains, oilseeds, dairy, sugar, cotton, vegetable oils, and other soft commodities. So Faro Capital, yeah, it's a relative value fundamental trading strategy, and we look at right across the globe, physical futures, OTC, option markets, and really looking for fundamental dislocation across the globe to deploy our investor capital. So fortunately, I've been joined by two other co-founders, one whom I work with at Merricks Capital, Les Finnemore, who's gone on to start his own hedge fund in the United States, and he's partnered now with me, and my other co-founder, Al Fullerton, who's got a long history in trading physical commodities throughout Asia and more recently in ag tech VC.
Awesome. Sounds like a fair bit of experience within the team then.
Yeah, we very much rely on our physical trading expertise. I spent maybe 14 years trading physical commodities in the food industry across Australasia, if you like, before moving into the hedge fund world in 2008, just pre the GFC, actually. So it was quite a good timing in that we saw lots of dislocation across markets in 2008, 09, during the financial crisis. And in fact, ironically, you know, one of our best trades during the financial crisis was actually taking delivery of physical milk powder, storing it, and hedging it out in the class three milk futures market, which at the time was at a 70% carry, 70 percent carry. And so we carried the milk powder forward physically and then traded it back into the market when, you know, supply chains started to loosen up again and letters of credit started to be reopened again, because it literally was a credit crisis. So we were obviously long cash and able to help facilitate trades by taking on physical, holding it, and when supply chain started to move again, sell it back into the market. So that really set us off on a path of sort of profitable trading, if you like, through the financial crisis. And on the back of that, we went and raised $600 million over the course of the next couple of years to really take our fund global. And we were probably one of the sort of longer sustaining commodity funds throughout that period over the course of the next 10 to 12 years. 13, 14 years. So that's great to be back, and we've learned a lot, and you know, we're spending a lot of time and resource in this particular business on our quantitative capability. So whilst we think about and trade markets very much from a fundamental perspective, a lot of investments going in building out our quantitative team. And that's really just building that capability to drag in millions of data points every day into bite-sized pieces or pieces of information that we can use from a discretionary perspective to trade our markets. It's something, a luxury that I would have loved to have had in the last sort of 15 years of trading, and we're really excited about bringing that technology, AI and machine learning, to our discretionary fundamental trading capability.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's more the AI and technology space, or is it the people as well within the quantitative analysis?
Yeah, look, it's both. We've just hired a senior quantitative analyst who's got a PhD in mathematical science. He's based out of Toronto, having worked for a large hedge fund in a very large US hedge fund, where he's built out a pod, if you like, within that organization as a researcher. So he starts on May 1st. And then we have four or five data engineers effectively pulling the data together into usable data sets. And that includes data like thousands of weather stations, shipping data, cash market data, stocks data, export data. And that's very accretive to our discretionary strategy. I think it allows us to see things more readily across a broader investment universe, if you like. and really find those points of dislocation for us to go and spend our time looking at and going deep in our research.
Yeah, awesome. And maybe going back to that trading story, you're kind of relying, I suppose, on market volatility as a function of kind of making a bit of profitable strategies. How do you go about that? Obviously, agricultural commodities are pretty volatile themselves.
Yep.
What's the thinking there?
Yeah, well, our strategy is relative value. So we're looking at one commodity's value relative to another and then looking to either for that relative value to converge to a long-term average, or we're looking perhaps for even that spread to diverge, for example, based on a set of number of expected events. So often we're looking at across the market, and weather's a really great example to illustrate to listeners in that. And I'll use the example perhaps South African or El Nino and South African weather, where yep. we saw El Nino really perpetrating a dry period that where rain kind of turned off on January 12 and really didn't rain again. And that had a really big impact on South African corn supply. And we were able through our models to be able to identify the fact that not only that rainfall had stopped, but immediately understand the impact of rainfall stopping to the productive capacity of that crop in terms of how it may impact yields and also how that may then roll into the supply and demand metrics, in which case, you know, from export in that particular country in that market, you go from export parity to import parity very quickly, and there's a 30 or 40% difference. So if you can, in a timely manner, identify areas of dislocation like that, or perhaps weather-induced potential issues, you can set your portfolio up to take advantage of potential factors happening. If those factors happen, you get this asymmetrical sort of payoff. If those factors don't happen, then you kind of go sideways. And in this particular case, the thesis continued to play out, got drier, drier, drier. The market had to shift from export to import parity of corn. And of course, the market's gone a lot higher. So certainly we rely on a level of volatility to extract that what we call alpha in the market, or you know, our performance of the underlying markets. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a volatile strategy. And I say that because it's important to note the difference between trading in volatile markets and having a volatile or strategy. So our realized volatility is less than 10%. So it's well below market volatility. So there are ways to extract investment returns from commodity trading markets without actually bearing the volatility of the underlying market.
Yeah, sort of managing that downside risk while maximizing that profit with various strategies.
Correct, and really looking at the spreads between two markets. So you might, for example, in the milk or dairy markets, looking at Europe, US, and perhaps Australia, New Zealand, and that, and looking for opportunities or dislocation between those markets. And what we've found in probably more recent times in that the physical merchants do a great job of moving commodities around the world. Those physical merchants have sort of slowly moved away from risk taking to a point where they're very much facilitating that logistical movement of commodities around the world and less risk taking. Us, Farrah Capital and other hedge funds, our role is really to be providing capital when capital is scarce. And so that means we also have the longevity or the patience of capital. So when there is a dislocation, we can apply our capital to the market, and perhaps we have to sit in a trade for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months or 4 months. We don't need to turn an asset. We're simply providing capital when it's scarce, and when capital is no longer scarce, probably we trade back out of that trade. And for us, we think that's accretive to the global trade, because that capital would otherwise be provided by financiers like banks and others, but even they have pulled back from financing in that in that regard, particularly where there's market risk. So they're very much, that's our role. We see our role as participating in the market flow like that. And the physical merchants do a great job of turning their assets as efficiently as they can, but they may not have the patience of capital to sit there with their balance sheet applied to a trade for months.
So is that pullback of capital from banks and the like sort of what made you decide that the time was right to launch? Like what sort of motivated you?
Yeah, well, to be perfectly honest, a bit of fear of missing out because we've really gone back to the conditions that we saw in sort of 06, 07, 08, 09 in commodity trading. And that's very much perpetrated by a higher interest rate environment. So a higher interest rate environment is accretive for our strategy because the way that we trade and think about geographic arbitrage is extracting that cost of money across the supply chain through trading strategy can extract that cost of capital across a supply chain. So certainly higher interest rates are accretive for our strategy. The second is climate change. So now I think all of us on a daily basis are feeling the effects of climate change. I know particularly in Australia, we seem to bear the brunt of the extremes in weather, and that's becoming more extreme. And those extremes are becoming more frequent. And so if those that are best educated into how those impacts of weather flow through to supply and demand and therefore market movements are best placed to make investment returns. So the fact that we're getting more volatile weather is accretive for our strategy. And probably the third one is geopolitical risk. And I think if you go back to last week with Israel bombing Iran, I think if we had this conversation 2 months ago and I said Israel is going to bomb Iran, you'd be like, that's World War III and markets will go crazy. The world's becoming a little bit better of absorbing some of the geopolitical risk, but still where geopolitical risk impacts supply chains or rerouting of supply chains is an area where we as commodity traders, if we're best informed in the marketplace, can identify those risks and or opportunities and then exploit those through our trading strategy. So, and I don't think geopolitical risk is going away necessarily very soon.
I was going to say there's probably weather's not going to go away and geopolitical risk isn't going to go away. So there's plenty of risk out there.
And we all hope interest rates fall, right? But but the likelihood is that inflation is probably higher for longer. Therefore, interest rates are higher for longer. And there's still a risk for inflation to come back at some point. And we've seen that historically, inflation comes back badder and meaner than it did before, and that's still a risk to the market as well. So we're not discounting that either.
Yeah, there's definitely some stickiness around. Not sure about Aussie, but here in New Zealand,
for sure,
still sticking around.
It is.
Yeah, cool. That's great summary, Adam. Just a question, maybe. Looking ahead into the future with global commodities and agricultural commodities specifically, sort of the biggest challenges facing the market today and into the future. You've probably touched on a couple already, but any of that sticking out?
I wouldn't say necessarily a challenge, but a big change coming this year that many of your listeners would be aware of is the shift from El Nino to La Nina. Expected mid-year. There's not, I wouldn't say there's complete agreement across the global models as to when or if there will be a full transition into La Nina. But I know the Bureau of Meteorology in Australia has identified we're now in a neutral position, and they're not quite convinced yet we're going to a La Nina. But the point being, whether we do or we don't, there is a shift coming mid-year in global weather. That's guaranteed. Yep. The question is, how does that impact markets? And we don't know. The answer is we don't know. But what we do know is that it will result in volatility somewhere around the globe in some form. And so our role, I guess, as traders or participants in our market, whether you're in the dairy market or other markets, is to identify if and when something happens, you know, what will be the market impacts. So that's one we're keenly watching because there's no doubt we're expecting some higher volatility. And of course, disease risk. And of course, dairy markets facing disease risk as we speak in the United States, bird flu spreading the dairy herd. So what does that mean from a broader market sense, not just from an impact on, you know, productive capability of that particular market, but what does it mean in terms of trade flows, export trade flows of dairy product around the world? Is there opportunities for the likes of New Zealand or Australia, for that matter, to take advantage of perception around the safety of the underlying commodity, i.e. whether it be dairy powder or other things? So disease risk, we've seen similar disease risk across livestock sectors in the past, in particular pork, of course, or hogs, if you like. So there's certainly challenges in the livestock sector that we're keenly aware of, and, you know, I think certainly pertinent today. And of course, let's not discount the US election that becomes comes later this year, and we take a view that, for example, a Republican win in that regard would actually bring quite a bit of volatility, particularly as pertains to trade. And so that's something all of us need to be aware of, is the trade policy of the Republicans is very different from the Democrats. So it has some pretty severe implications for the likes of Mexico, for example.
So are you putting trade strategies in place now for those types of events to kind of occur later down the track, or is it sort of a watching brief at the moment?
No, certainly we're participating in the avian flu issue in the United States today. We're positioning from a weather perspective today. We're thinking about how we best exploit those potential weather changes, and from the geopolitical perspective too, our portfolio and the way we think about the markets is very much about identifying opportunities where, if a number of factors happen, then you get an outsized investment return. If nothing happens, then you probably go sideways, or maybe you lose a little bit. But setting the portfolio up for that kind of event risk, and the markets become very, very complacent around whether it be geopolitical risk or any other risk at the moment. We've seen almost record shorts across the CME in soybeans, corn, wheat, and other commodities in the past few couple of months. So there is a level of complacency there across the marketplace, which I think provides an opportunity for at some point an event turning markets around relatively sharply. So we're obviously pretty cognizant of that ability for the market to have to go into a short covering rally to cover that positioning at some point, as we saw even as recent as Thursday, Friday with the happenings in Iran, Israel, for example, very sharp rally, as we saw markets sort of short cover.
What's sort of causing that complacency, I guess, in the market, Adam? Is there anything specific there?
No, quite honestly, they're probably well-placed positioning. They're trading the fundamental view, today's fundamental view, which is larger production coming online into a softer demand profile. So if you put all the possible event risk to the side and say, how would you best position for today's market as we sit today? That's exactly how we should be positioned. It probably doesn't account for the event risk, but then with information moving as quickly as it does and the ability to trade those trade flows as quickly as you can, perhaps it's a matter of trade today's balance sheet, and when the event happens, then act on the event. It just means that when the event happens, the volatility is greater as the money flow shifts back into short covering that positioning much quicker. So you'll see bigger moves. So I guess in these environments, and we've seen this before, on the back of high prices, you get pullback from consumers consuming. If you like, and that once the consumers actually start consuming less, it's actually very hard, even with prices coming down, to turn on consumer demand again. So you tend to get this tail effect to high prices. We're still feeling it today. High prices flows through the consumer. They pull back, stop consuming. Even when prices fall, they'll still be reluctant to consume. You get this big long tail, and you'll find that that consumption disappoints in terms of your expectations from the market. And we're sort of going through that now. And so it's almost as though every bullish event in the marketplace is just getting this big, heavy, wet towel, if you like, placed over it, going, you can't go too high because you'll cut off all demand.
Yep.
And that's definitely been a feature of energy markets and agricultural markets as well. That will shift, though, don't get me wrong, perhaps towards the end of this year. But today, that's how the market's reacting to that.
Yeah, brilliant. Well summarised. Adam, I think that's probably it for today. We've gone a decent stint there and covered a fair bit of info. So thanks so much for joining us today. It's been epic to have you on the podcast, and excited to see where Farah Capital goes. And excited to hear from you in a couple months' time when it's all good to go.
Thanks, James. Absolute pleasure. And look forward to staying in contact.
Cheers, Adam.
The information provided in this podcast is a guide and is intended for general information purposes only. The information is not investment advice. The information should not be relied upon as a substitute for detailed advice from a professional advisor. The podcast may contain opinions or forward-looking statements, and actual results may vary from what is expressed in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the presenter or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of NZX. NZX Limited is not liable for any loss suffered through relying on the information in this podcast. NZX makes no warranties as to the accuracy or completeness of the information in this podcast. All intellectual property rights in the content of this podcast are owned or used under license by NZX, and NZX's written consent is required to use, redistribute, or reproduce the content, or use it to create other works.